Hello and welcome to Employment Law Matters. This is Season 6, Episode 9, and it's the 23rd of May, 2023. In this episode, you'll learn about whistleblowing. Things you'll hear include how can you tell if something is a protected disclosure? What are the pros and cons of an interim relief application? And when is a disclosure in the public interest? I'm Barrister Daniel Barnett, a member of Outer Temple Chambers, presenter of The Legal Hour on LBC Radio, and founder of the HR Inner Circle. In this season, I'm picking my favourite dozen episodes from the series of 30 employment law webinars I ran back in 2021, where a leading employment lawyer answered questions over Zoom from hundreds of solicitors and HR professionals. I've not only picked my favourite dozen episodes, I've selected the best questions and answers from each of those episodes for you. This week, we're looking at whistleblowing claims, and I'm playing extracts from a webinar I did with Tom Croxford, King's Counsel of Blackstone Chambers. Just before we turn to Tom, if you're an HR professional, I do want to let you know about the HR Inner Circle, hrinnercircle.co.uk. You've probably heard me talk about it before. It's a vibrant, active community that I set up in 2015 of caring, like-minded HR professionals who want to help you. It lifts your work burden by giving you swift access to comprehensive resources and live practical guidance that you can implement right away. The HR Inner Circle is packed full of practical, actionable advice for you that's difficult to find anywhere else. And it doesn't matter what you're working on, whether it's workforce engagement, attracting and keeping talent, diversity and inclusion, or employee health and well-being, you'll find support for all of that. You're covered even if you're working on one of those tricky, sensitive people problems that you never see coming until they land squarely on your plate. Have a look. You can become part of the HR Inner Circle community for just £96 plus VAT a month. www.hrinnercircle.co.uk. Turning now to whistleblowing. Tom Croxford, King's Counsel, is a barrister at Blackstone Chambers. He's been in numerous whistleblowing trials over the years, almost equally acting for claimants and respondents. He's done 7 interim relief applications over the years. I was actually against him a few years ago in the Employment Appeal Tribunal the morning after the evening he'd received the email from the QC appointments panel, as it was known then, telling him he'd been appointed a silk. Talk about an opponent in a good mood. The Legal 500 says he is, quote, undoubtedly one of the top employment barristers at the bar and right at the top of his game in restraint of trade and whistleblowing claims. No one has more experience. With accolades like that, who better could I bring to talk to you and answer your questions about whistleblowing than Tom Croxford, KC?
Welcome to Employment Law Matters with Barrister Daniel Barnett.
Protective disclosures. What are the biggest issues that a lot of people worry about is how they know at the time they might get a grievance or a letter or a complaint from an employee, whether or not it contains a protected disclosure. How do you tell?
It's very hard. Simply put, it's very hard. And one can see from the reported cases that it's particularly hard to persuade a judge that it's obviously not a protected disclosure. You look at a case like Babula, where Mr. Babula complained about a fellow teacher in Waltham Forest, and he reported him to the FBI and the CIA for being a potential terrorist. And that case carried on up in the early stage of this process, and that was found to be a protected disclosure. So I suppose what you look at is, classically, what information is there? Does the information in the subjective belief of the individual making the disclosure tend to show a relevant failure, a breach of a legal obligation, criminal offence, and so on? And does that employee believe that the disclosure is in the public interest? Now, you should be able to get some of that from the document, but the context is also important. And actually the recent case, very good recent case of Twist DX, which is a recent decision of Tom Linden, Mr. Justice Linden, in the EAT, is that often what's important is actually the reasonable belief point. Because, of course, a disclosure has to be in the reasonable belief, of the employee to tend to show relevant failure, and that the disclosure is in the public interest. And that can be, the turning point, I suppose. I mean, if you just think of it in a Trump and election fraud way, I always like to turn to Trump and election fraud in relation to this sort of point. He genuinely believes that the election is stolen. He discloses information saying there was voter fraud. Dead voters were voting. Well, you look at the cases. Kilrain is the classic one to go back to. That information might well be sufficient. He might well have a subjective belief that there's a breach of election law, that the disclosure is in the public interest. It's innately election fraud, public interest. But is it a reasonable belief? Well, that's where I suppose one would expect that to fall down, particularly once enough judges have said, there's no evidence of it. And that's where you go back to the information. Is the information of a type, of a sort, that is likely to show in the reasonable belief of anyone that there has been a breach of relevant obligation?
Quick interruption from me, I'll only be 15 seconds. Two requests, please. Number one, if you've got any friends or colleagues who might benefit from subscribing to this podcast, please send them the link, go.danielbarnett.com/subscribe. Second of all, please do leave a review on whatever podcast software or system you use. It does make all the difference. Thanks. Now back to the episode.
What are the pros and cons? You've done 7 interim relief applications, which is more than most people. What are the pros and cons of making an application for interim relief, and what should an employer do to prepare for one?
Well, just to return to the nature of interim relief, which is an important starting point. Interim relief can only be brought within 7 days of the effective date of termination. It gets round the ACAS conciliation process. You've got to get your application very fast. Immediately after the dismissal takes effect, within 7 days, the tribunal then has to list the hearing as soon as possible, and adjourning that hearing is ought to be next to impossible, though in practice it may be a bit easier in some tribunals. So you're in a hearing within a few weeks of the dismissal. It's the closest you get to an employment tribunal making an injunction. And if the claimant is successful, the claimant carries on being paid all the way through to the substantive hearing. And that money probably can't be clawed back in any way, shape or form. And it's a public hearing, the interim relief hearing. And so many claimants think, well, this will force the respondent to the table at an early stage by making an application. The claimant thinks, well, this is the point at which the respondent will go, let's keep this out of the public domain. Let's settle the whole case now. It's a common belief, and I've brought applications for interim relief for claimants with that view. But my longer experience is that that view is mainly wrong. It is rare for respondents to be able to get their head around settling a case in time before the interim relief hearing is heard, and therefore actually that in and of itself makes it less likely to settle. Also, it's the best chance for the respondent of actually winning a hearing in the case itself. The test for interim relief is a high one. The tribunal has to be satisfied that there is a pretty good chance of success, having taken account of the evidence. And that is not that hard. If you think about how hard it is to win a substantive trial on whistleblowing, it's never easy, and it generally turns on causation. Was the reason for the dismissal actually a protected disclosure, or was it something else? Something not, perhaps even related, but not the protected disclosure itself. And this is at a point where there's been no disclosure. And so for a respondent, preparation is key as well. If you know that there is a claimant who's perhaps brought a grievance in relation to whistleblowing already, and you, the respondent, will probably not always know that he's about to be dismissed. It may be a constructive dismissal. But then that's the point to start thinking in advance, because once the application for interim relief lands, you may only have a couple of weeks, maybe not even that, to get everything in order. And again, Daniel, I know you've done some of these cases recently as well. Generally, the way they run is with evidence being in a witness statement, but no cross-examination and extensive citation of authority. I think we were about 30 authorities in the last case I fought for the respondent. We won. And it's that preparation, getting ahead of it, working out who you're going to have witness statements from, disciplining officer, quite likely HR, the person who seems to have been key to the decision, and a person who can say what's been going on in the background. And they're very tough indeed for employment tribunal judges to deal with. In my experience, it's half a day of frantic reading, perhaps more than that, sometimes a day and a half of frantic reading, trying to get up to speed with the authorities on interim relief. And then a hard fight between often experienced counsel hammering it out in front of you for a day. It's a tough case.
I just want to make a comment and ask a question. The question, you said that normally or rarely can the respondent claw back the interim relief continuation of employment salary payments. What are the circumstances where they might?
The only circumstance I can think of, and the reason they're public hearings, is that in principle, they are not capable of being clawed back. It is possible that if the claim itself is based upon fraud, i.e. a claimant has deliberately lied, and you can show that the claimant has deliberately lied, you might be able to go back and undo the initial decision for interim relief at some later point. I have to say, I've never heard anyone attempt it. I've certainly never seen it done, and I think it would be most unlikely to succeed. And the reason that they're public hearings is the final determination of entitlement to salary for the period from the interim relief hearing through to the substantive hearing.
And the observation is simply that these are very peculiar hearings in the sense that often the judge will be deciding fairly fundamental questions between the parties, albeit on, you know, a fair degree of certainty as opposed to balance of probability. There's a different test. But doing so without the ET3, because the respondent often won't have got round to lodging their ET3.
Indeed. And a respondent may have to take a tactical decision as to whether it wants an ET3 on the stocks or not, because generally speaking, it will interrupt the preparation of the interim relief hearing to be simultaneously preparing the ET3. And so, yes, there's often no ET3. In my experience, most of the ET judges I've been in front of on an interim relief hearing have never done an interim relief hearing before. They're not common hearings. And so they're asking their mates in the judiciary, what do I do now? What's the right answer? Looking at their bench book, trying to work out. And as a result, they're exciting hearings. They're always exciting.
Breeden Consulting provides small and medium businesses with the breadth of HR support usually enjoyed by large corporates. So if you want practical and commercially focused HR support, or if you're an HR professional looking for an opportunity to capitalise on your experience by joining a great team, visit breedonconsulting.co.uk.
Sue Apps has the most popular question with 46 thumbs up. Sue, I don't know how you do it. You're always one of the first people to get questions asked. She asks, to what extent can a breach of an individual contract or a personal grievance be something that can be reasonably believed to be in the public interest? Can you give any examples of when this will and won't be the case?
Well, in principle, if it is simply a breach of your own contract or a personal issue that you have with somebody, that is not in the public interest. The very reason for the government changing the whistleblowing legislation was to stop precisely these arguments coming before the tribunal. I think that you'd need to take it a bit beyond the mere personal breach of contract and seek as a claimant to elevate it into something more structural or fundamental. I still think that one sees it, for example, in relation to discrimination, and I can't be too specific because I've got some pending cases where this is raised, saying that a complaint of discrimination against the employer is capable of being a public interest disclosure because discrimination is bad and wrong. Well, I think that's going to be tricky to persuade any tribunal of, that it's not fundamentally and at heart a private interest that is being addressed rather than something that is a public interest. I can see, though, that perhaps if it's an equal pay type argument, mass equal pay type argument, it might be much easier to say that that is a publicly interested disclosure. Some of it may depend upon how the disclosure is made as well, in that if you frame that the disclosure itself has, I'm complaining about systemic discrimination in relation to pay in this, by way of example, public sector organisation, I think that might be much easier to persuade a tribunal of, even though the reason, perhaps the motivation for making the disclosure, which is, of course, not strictly speaking relevant now, the motivation might be private, the interest might be persuadable to be public.
And there was a case, wasn't there, that was in the EAT, went to the Supreme Court, but settled before the Supreme Court hearing, which dealt with the four factors which go towards whether a disclosure is in the public interest.
Well, no Mohammed. Is that the one?
Mohammed. Yeah,
Underhill judgment. That has, again, received further support in Twisty X. I think it's Justice Lyndon cites it with some slight tweaks around the edges, perhaps, in relation to the meanings. I think it's worth looking at both of those. But yes, fundamentally, it is looking at whether, it's not the motivation, it is about whether, in fact, in truth, it is subjectively believed in the public interest and, separately, reasonably, objectively, in the public interest.
And I just want to add one other thing to that, Tom. I'm so sorry. There could be a technical foul in a tribunal case if the claimant doesn't give evidence that they actually believe the disclosure to be in the public interest. And there's a case called Ibrahim, which says that the absence of saying that can cause a claimant to technically lose. Now, there are problems with that case, but that's the law at the moment.
There are, and it's always worth remembering that, theoretically at least, the claimant has the burden of proving every element of a protected disclosure, and therefore the claimant has to give evidence as to it. And again, actually back to this nice new case of Twisty X, the claimant has to give evidence of their subjective belief as to what head of protected disclosures the information tends to show. And it's not enough to say it tended to show that there was a breach. They have to show in relation to each of them separately why they believe it tended to show that relevant failure. And that may be more complicated for some claimants who may perhaps have burnished their evidence a little as it goes through the process of getting to a substantive hearing.
Natalie White asks, can employers discipline an employee who commits misconduct to uncover information that they make a disclosure about, such as accessing private files?
In principle, yes. And indeed, it's not uncommon for this situation to arise. I think that, as ever, one needs to tread with caution. If the employee has in fact discovered something truly awful, then disciplining them as your first step, when rather than investigating the truly awful thing that they appear to have uncovered, again, might not be the best plan. In principle, yes, of course, if they commit misconduct, and particularly where that misconduct is not something that also is said to be the protected disclosure, one can and one generally will seek to investigate it first. I think that that's another of the examples where, and it depends a bit on how your disciplinary policies are framed, but being very careful to distinguish between the investigation phase and the discipline phase is perhaps the best approach. And if one investigates it perhaps more neutrally first, and then perhaps again pushes things down two different routes from then on, if circumstances justify it, i.e. one, investigation of the internal misconduct that amounts to the protected disclosure, and separately, the disciplinary offence of committing misconduct. But balancing those can be very tricky.
Stu Apps asks, what practical steps can an employer take when taking unrelated disciplinary action against someone who has blown the whistle to limit the risk of successful allegations of automatic unfair dismissal? So you've got a whistleblower, you've got separate disciplinary allegations. How do you stop the claimant or a tribunal saying causation, not correlation?
I mean, that's at the heart, I suppose, of almost every whistleblowing trial I've actually fought, and I've fought a number now. In a perfect world, one might have a person determining the disciplinary allegation who had, at least at the outset, no knowledge of the whistleblowing, the protected disclosure, and therefore it would make it innately more difficult for that person to be dismissing by reason of the protected disclosure itself. Albeit that we see in cases like Ducey, for example, the difficult questions of attribution of the incorrect evidence of one disciplinary officer in relation to the tribunal itself. If a company relies upon false information that's been deliberately put in front of the company so that the whistleblower gets forced out, then no amount of clever engineering of your disciplinary process and your whistleblowing process are going to get in the way of a finding of automatic unfair dismissal. I think though the key bit is, as ever, careful investigation, careful discipline, and a good decision maker making a sensible, right, correct decision and reasoning it effectively.
Radar is a specialist commercial and litigation law firm dedicated to helping businesses navigate their risk, including employment issues. Radar's legal expertise and innovative digital tools focus on educating businesses before problems happen. Book your free 30-minute employment and HR consultation today, or subscribe to their monthly newsletter at Radar, that's RRADAR, radar.com/employment.
An anonymous attendee asks, for a whistleblowing dismissal, if you're acting for the claimant, would you always recommend naming the dismissing manager as second respondent for an Osipov detriment type claim? Could you just explain in one sentence what an Osipov claim is?
Yes. So it is bringing a detriment claim for personal damages against the individual, for the detriment of having been subjected to something other than dismissal by the employer. So if it's a dismissal, the only claim that can be brought in relation to that is in relation to directly the unfair dismissal against the employer, but a detriment claim can be brought against anybody. And it's quite common to see more and more respondents being brought in relation to detriment claims. Unconvinced that they always add much, it's become quite common to just add endless individual respondents that has a habit actually of making the claim more complicated, particularly if the other respondents seek separate representation. You can very easily double the length of the eventual tribunal hearing by the increased complexity, make it more difficult for the tribunal to resolve it, and only to a trivial extent get greater damages as a result. But I can see pros and cons both ways, and it's more common, I find, for a claimant to justify bringing in some bigwig US manager directly into the purview of the UK employment tribunals as a way of actually forcing the head office, wherever they may be, the US or Brazil or anywhere else it may be, to actually focus on what they may be hoping to think is a trivial case in some godforsaken global backwater.
That was Tom Croxford, King's Counsel of Blackstone Chambers. Tom, thank you. Join me next Tuesday, the 30th of May 2023, when I'll be bringing you highlights from my webinar with Karen Jackson of Didlaw, in which she answers questions on disability discrimination. Thank you for listening. If you're an HR professional, please do have a look at hrinnercircle.co.uk. You will love it. I'm Barrister Daniel Barnett. Stay safe.
Any information on this podcast is for general guidance only. Always seek legal advice. Please see full terms at www.danielbarnett.co.uk/podcast-terms.